Chapter 3 continued. Even the introduction of a Bible reading lectern was attacked at Northampton as being churchy, an umbrella accusation which has been used to attack a great many innovations. The latest endeavour to help those having personal and psychological problems through the care group has inevitably met with the same kind of protests. Those who want to get things done or to suggest new ways of doing them in our community must be prepared to run the gauntlet of criticism from a reactionary rearguard who would prefer everything to remain as it was in the 19th century so far as Christadelphianism is concerned, though in their personal lives they are often willing to accept all the advantages of 20th century affluence. Still, we got our youth circle, and many of the middle-aged parents now active in the truth in Northampton and many other ecclesias came up through the Sunday school and youth circle in this way. Outdoor preaching still held a fascination for me, in spite of the apparent ineffectiveness of it as a means of making converts. I had been in the habit of going into the marketplace on Sunday evenings after the lecture and holding forth from the fountain steps, a recognised public forum. On one occasion there was a big Roman Catholic meeting taking place there, and I decided to cross-question the speaker, a Jesuit priest. There was a huge audience, many of whom were Irish, and a number of priests supporting their main preacher. I managed to get in a question about the disparity between the pretensions of the Pope and the humility of his supposed original, St. Peter, quoting the words of Peter himself, that shepherds were not to lord it over Christ's heritage, but to be clothed with humility. 1 Peter 5, verse 3. At this point there was a lot of uproar from the Catholic crowd, and a brother who had accompanied me to the meeting on his motorcycle thought he would have to whisk me away on his pillion seat. But just then there was another interruption, and to my aid came Brother Laurie Lyle, a brother who had been out of fellowship for many years and had joined the splinter group over the new hymn book. He was a redoubtable public speaker and an experienced debater, and his diversionary question sounded innocuous enough. Was the doctrine of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary a defined doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church? No, replied the priest. It was a doctrine that most Catholics believed, but it had not been defined by the Holy Father. Was it likely to be defined? Was the next question. Not as far as the priest knew, came the answer. Well then, said Brother Lyle, I'll tell you. It will be defined next year when the Pope will make it obligatory for all Catholics. That is what defining means. So you can please yourself this year, but next year you will have to believe it or be guilty of mortal sin. It was a very clever trap he had set, for the doctrine was defined the following year, and it serves to illustrate what are the skills of public debate, i.e. to know more about your opponent's case than he does himself. My personal view is, however, that debates generally do very little good. Each side puts up a man to represent their particular viewpoint, and each side remains convinced at the end that their man has won. The investigation of truth is not served by it, as neither of the protagonists is likely to concede that there is, after all, something in what the other man has put forward. His supporters would tear him to pieces if he did. And a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Discussion is a different thing and can be very helpful in the pursuit of truth. William Hazlitt defined the difference between argument and discussion as follows. In an argument, a group of people sit round a table and each tries to make the others accept his point of view. Result? Everybody remains in their entrenched positions, and ill will is probably all that is generated. In a genuine discussion, on the other hand, a group of people sit round and each puts on the table what he knows about the subject, and everybody is profited. Generally speaking, in our community, we are good at argument but poor in discussion. We are not very willing to listen to others' views, though very ready to pronounce our own. In the case mentioned above, Brother Lyle was a doughty debater, but in the discussions over the hymn book, showed no willingness to listen to any opinion but his own. Nor was he alone in this. I remember Brother C.C. Walker writing in the magazine about a conversation he had with a lady who would, he said, insist on saying, "Well, I think," and he replied with characteristic bluntness, "What does it matter what you think?" Now, of course, he was right in the sense no human opinion is of any importance against the Word of God. But since the discussion was presumably on what the Word taught, it was a little arrogant to tell her that she had no right to express her view, and I doubt whether she would have felt that his view was the only one possible. But it is, regrettably, quite a familiar attitude among us. We were in Northampton for 8 years, for 4 of which I had the job of recording Brother. It came about in this way. Brother Percy Flinders suffered deteriorating health through his Great War experiences, and eventually had to resign and later died. He had been a good servant of the truth in Northampton. To fill the vacancy pro tem, I was appointed by the arranging brethren whilst away on holiday, from which I returned to be told that the mantle of Elijah had fallen upon me, the youngest of all the arranging brethren. It was a particularly unhappy and difficult period for the Northampton Ecclesia, and one which I look back on with no great pleasure. There was a contention over a booklet written by Brethren Graham Pierce and H.C. Gates called Fellowship and Withdrawal, which had caused a great stir among some of the Midland Ecclesias, complicated by the fact that Brother Pierce was said to be meeting from time to time with an ecclesia in Coventry which was associated with the Suffolk Street Fellowship, with which at that time we had no dealings, like the Jews and the Samaritans. The situation became more and more complex due to pressure for action against Brother Pierce from other ecclesias and from the editor of the Christadelphian magazine, Brother John Carter. Believing Brother Graham Pierce to be a sincere, if misguided, brother, we tried to placate our critics by issuing a declaration to the effect that we dissociated ourselves from his views, as expressed in the booklet, but felt that he should be allowed to retain his fellowship in the community. This, however, was not considered sufficient by his critics, and the time came when our ecclesial notices were refused publication in the magazine, which was tantamount to being ostracised by the establishment in Birmingham. Brother Leslie Bartlett and I were therefore deputed to visit Brother Carter to explain our position, but to no avail, and eventually we had to withdraw fellowship from Brother Graham Pierce at a tense and unhappy special business meeting. What strange things are done in the name of Christ. Looking back now some 30 years later, I am sickened at the attitudes of those times, and would never now accept what then seemed unavoidable. Why should a brother be forced out of our fellowship because of pressure from outside? However awkward some of his views and attitudes may have been, by what right do we decide that he shall not remember Christ with us in the breaking of bread? Brother Graham Pearce was able to resume fellowship some years later when reunion with Suffolk Street Ecclesias took place, and we found that we were all in fellowship after all. So all that he had done was to anticipate a reunion in which most of us have rejoiced now for many years. And he is now an accepted and highly regarded speaker and writer in the Central Fellowship and recording brother of the Rugby Ecclesia. So what was all the fuss about? And why was there so much bitterness and unhappiness? I have only touched on these events, which went on over a long period, to draw attention to the sad side of Christadelphianism, its contentiousness and tendency to strife. We have a long history of divisiveness, perhaps because we care about the truth. But what cruelties and heartbreaks have been caused by this argumentative and intellectual attitude, as it was once described by a well-known defector from our ranks, only the Lord knows. It was the great apostle who warned, "If ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another." A warning that is as apposite today as ever. I am not always sure that our care about truth is as great as our concern about what we call the truth. On a lighter note, I must refer back to the visit made by Leslie Bartlett and me to the home of Brother John Carter in Birmingham. Forgetting the theological argumentation which went on late into the night, I remember him as a very kind and modest man, whom I got to know even better later on. Our discussions took us all the time until midnight, and when we came to leave, there was a veritable pea super of a fog which made it impossible for us to return to Northampton that night, and Brother John insisted that we should sleep there. In the morning he called us early and himself prepared our breakfast. I believe Sister Carter was not well. I have the picture still of the editor of the Christadelphia magazine standing over the frying pan getting eggs and bacon for his unexpected guests. It reminds me how little we often know about the person behind the person. We perhaps see a brother speaking on the platform regularly, and we shake his hand at the meeting, and we think we know him. But do we, really? How many of our hordes of friends and brethren do we really know? It is in the intimacies of the home that we get to know one another. When you have seen that famous brother in bed in his pyjamas with his teeth out, or cooking eggs and bacon for you over a hot stove. The early post-war years were marked by even greater food shortages than during the war itself, and it was in this period that bread rationing was introduced. It seems strange looking back that supply should have been so short, but the bakery trade was particularly affected, and the limited supply of essential raw materials had to be supplemented by imported commodities from abroad. Sugar from Britain's sugar beet factories was being sent to the continent, mixed with vegetable oils, and returned for sale to the trade here at twice or three times the price, because it was available off the ration. My brother bought large quantities of this material to supplement his meagre rations, and we were therefore able to keep the shops supplied and also take on a fair amount of outside catering for shows, gymkhanas, weddings, etc., which was one of the areas of the business entrusted to me. The catering was of a fairly primitive order, but was in good demand because of the shortage, and I recall that Brother Fred Mitchell, who was secretary of the South Eastern branch of the ALS, had to come to us 2 years running to do the catering at the annual gathering held at that time in the Memorial Hall of Harrington Street in central London. This gathering was a great institution in London and the Home Counties for many years, going back into the 1920s. It was always preceded in the afternoon by a visit to the British Museum, when Brother Fred and a team of helpers conducted parties of brethren and sisters around the various galleries which held special interest for Bible students. It is difficult to convey the sense of excitement which prevailed when the meeting assembled in the famous, and as it seemed to us at the time, splendid Victorian Memorial Hall to listen to well-known brethren exhorting us from the Scriptures. There was an atmosphere about the place and the occasion which only those who attended will be able to recapture. It was the Mecca for Christadelphians, not only in the London area, but from as far afield as Portsmouth, Southampton, Bournemouth, and even Northampton. I remember going there with my parents as a boy, and later as a young man from Northampton, and I still recall the exhibits at the British Museum, as well as the tired feet from standing around the cases. Seemed to me that they missed out the more exciting galleries, massive Babylonian figures, Greek sculptures, etc., to concentrate on some case containing cuneiform inscriptions which bore on biblical history. But the one was of purely human interest, the other divine. The purely human often has more instant appeal to the natural mind. The whole event, the British Museum outing and Memorial Hall gathering, as it was called, was something which has never been replaced, a nostalgic memory from the past. You may imagine, therefore, the sense of awe, and to some extent of achievement, which I experienced in being asked to be one of the speakers there for the first time. This came while still at the Reading meeting, either during or just after the war, when still in my 20s, and it was a great occasion for me, needless to say. There were 3 speakers, of whom I was last, and the 2 previous had gone over their time, a well-known Christadelphian custom, so that the meeting was running late. Brother Fred Mitchell, who was presiding, leaned across to me during the hymn before my address, to encourage me and to tell me not to worry about the time, but to give my talk as I had prepared it. It was just a thoughtful little touch for a young man on a big occasion, and I still appreciate it, even though he has now fallen asleep. Now we were to help him out by coming all the way from Northampton to supply the tea, which we did not only that year, but also the following year, when again I had been asked to take one of the 3 addresses. So I had the privilege of assisting in the supply of both the natural and the spiritual food for the occasion. It is strange how such gatherings as these seem to represent an era, and with their passing there is something irrecoverable. I wonder if the new generation of young Christadelphians have anything to match them, and whether there is anything taking place now which, in their old age, they will think back on with the same nostalgia. The Fountain Court gatherings in the New Forest have the same effect on those who attended them. These were held in the summertime at the home of Brother George Blake. Fountain Court was a lovely country house with extensive grounds, and each year he had a marquee erected in the grounds for a meeting of about 400. It was a great occasion. There was the inevitable cricket match in the afternoon, followed by tea and a fraternal meeting in the marquee. Incidentally, I wonder that cricket always seems to have been an acceptable game for Christadelphians to play, whilst football is often considered worldly. Brother Isaac Collier once said that a brother he knew criticised another brother for attending a football match, though it was known that he himself used to go to watch county cricket. When this was pointed out to him, he replied, "Ah, but that's different." Brother Isaac commented that as far as he could see, the only difference was that whereas football occupied an afternoon, cricket took all day. The Fountain Court gatherings, like the Memorial Hall gatherings, have gone into the limbo of things we used to do. But many who read these words will get a strange thrill in their remembrance, and forgotten faces of dear friends and loved ones in the Lord will come back with the remembrance. One other thing of note I recall from my post-war stay in Northampton. It was a special effort meeting we arranged to take place in the town hall, and the subject was to be Roman Catholicism deluding the world, the papal system of idolatry scripturally exposed and condemned. It was a bold enough title, and I doubt whether we should be quite so direct today. When our posters went up in the town, the authorities withdrew the use of the town hall, so we had to take another public hall instead. Brother John Carter was booked to give the lecture and I to preside. We had a packed hall with over 100 strangers, many of whom are Irish Catholics. It was the most difficult meeting I've ever had to handle, and although I had explained that questions would be dealt with at the conclusion, there were such constant and noisy interruptions from some vociferous and incensed Catholics that Brother Carter twice had to sit down while I tried to subdue the audience and get a fair hearing for him. But again a little later came more shouted interruptions, and at this point a rather imposing gentleman stood up and said something on these lines: "Ladies and gentlemen, I am a Justice of the Peace of the Borough of Northampton, and I give you notice that if there are any more interruptions, I shall have you ejected from this meeting. The chairman has told you the terms on which the meeting is being held, and you may question the speaker at the end. So, will you please observe the chairman's ruling or leave the hall? And I say this in my capacity as a Justice of the Peace." We had no more trouble. A brother remarked to me afterwards, "The earth helped the woman," a reference which I fear may be lost on many of the present generation. That same night, weary and excited by the meeting, I drove home to discover two bodies lying in the road near where I lived. One was an elderly woman, and the other a motorcyclist who had evidently crashed into her in the darkness. I turned my car round so as to shield the bodies from oncoming traffic, and shall never forget the sight of my headlights shining on the broken bodies. They both died before the ambulance could get them to hospital. So I had something else to remember that night by. Before leaving these post-war years, I will tell you the story of a brother with whom we had a lot to do, who came into our lives for a short time and disappeared without trace. I tell his story only in the hope that if he's still alive, which I doubt, and should he ever see these memoirs, which is even less likely, he will get in touch with me again. His name was Bill Robinson, not an uncommon name, and not the Bill Robinson who is known to many today for his activities in the truth. And he was a Geordie from the Newcastle area. He came into the truth while working in the Bristol area. He worked in a gang who went around the country putting up prefabricated houses. It was rough work and rough company, and Bill was a rough man. He had hoboed around in America and Canada before coming back to this country after the war, and labouring was his type of work. But he had a good mind and a surprising depth of character. He saw a notice in the Christadelphian Hall about a lecture on prophecy and decided to go. He was converted and became a staunch and loving brother. I first met him at a fraternal gathering in Bristol, of which I was booked to speak. I sat at tea next to this unknown brother, and I remember he said to me that he was looking forward to the meeting, though he didn't know who this brother Richardson was. I was too shy to tell him, and left him to find out. However, we became good friends, and we entertained him at our home several times. When he fell out of work, he came to live with us in Northampton while he looked for a job. We loved his simplicity, and the children loved him because he was an interesting character. It was, by the way, he who had accompanied me to the open air meeting on his motorcycle when we had our encounter with the Catholic priest. He grew restless at being unable to find work in Northampton and went back to look for a job in Newcastle. But after about a month later, he was back with us, but changed. Something had happened in the north, but he never told us what. He became strange and more restless, though he still had a very good relationship with us, and we loved him. One day he said he was going into Buckinghamshire, where he had heard there was work. He went off in the morning, and we never saw him again. Some few days later, I got a letter from him from London. It was one of the saddest I've ever received. It said he had decided to leave the truth. He felt he could never live up to it. There were good sheep and bad sheep, and I guess I'm just one of the bad sheep. Just as sure as Paul was that there was laid up for him a crown of life, so I'm sure there isn't for me, nor ever can be. He sent his love and thanked us for what we had done. My wife Agnes had been very kind to him, and that was that. I wrote to beg him to come home and talk things over, but got no reply. A brother in the meeting was going to London, so I gave him the address and asked him to try to find Bill and get him to come home. He found the address, which was in such a low area that he was ashamed to be seen there. But nobody even knew him. He had disappeared without trace, and we had lost him. I've often wondered what had happened to him in the north and what kind of trouble he had got into which he felt could never be forgiven. What became of him? Where did he go? To whom could he go? Later on, when I travelled over Great Britain as a company representative, I often used to stop to pick up vagrants on the road, thumbing their aimless way through life, hoping that one day I would find Bill Robinson. But I never did. Chapter 4. Oxford. We left Northampton in 1954, when I got a job as a representative for a London-based company selling raw materials to bakery and catering establishments. We already knew the Ecclesia from my frequent speaking visits and settled there quite happily. Some of the characters associated with the early days of the Oxford Ecclesia come to mind a little larger than life, and it has also had many of our best known brethren pass through the university. Brother E.H. Tipping was a great worker there in the early days and built their present hall. He was a big man in every sense of the word and one of the comparatively few brethren in the pre-war years who could be described as wealthy. At any rate, he appeared so to his poorer brethren when he arrived to speak at Northampton in a chauffeur-driven car. Such luxury was quite outside our experience. He is probably best known for his hymn, "The days are quickly flying and Christ will come again," though one wonders how many today even realise that these words were written by one of our own brethren. I recall speaking at a fraternal gathering at Oxford just after the war, while still at Northampton, of which Brother Tipping was president. He liked me, or at any rate he liked my speaking, and if Brother Tipping liked anybody in those days, they were invited to speak there, for what he said was law. So I got invited 3 years running. Fortunately, I had the sense to decline on the third occasion, realising that it was becoming ridiculous. On the occasion in question, we sang his hymn, and he commented that when he wrote the words we have just been singing, he little thought that 50 years later we should still be waiting for the Lord to come. Now, another 30 years on, he himself is asleep, with every conflict ended and every sorrow past, waiting for the cry to go up triumphant, "The Lord has come at last." It reminds us how very careful we should be in making prognostications about the time of Christ's return, for generations of believers have expected it in their lifetime, and like Brother Tipping, are now asleep. It is the fact of his return that is important, not the timing. On this same occasion too, Brother Gilbert Smith was one of the speakers, and he used this hymn to illustrate his address in an outrageous and amusing manner. Speaking on the signs of Christ's coming, he explained that near his home in Birmingham there was a railway station which the oncoming trains approached round a bend, so that passengers awaiting its arrival knew of its approach before it came into sight by the rattle of the rails, and were able to get themselves ready beforehand. So, the rattle of the rails was like the signs of the times. We knew Christ was near because we could hear the rattle of the rails. And after all, he added, we have sung in our hymn, "The days are quickly flying and Christ will come again, with all his saints attending, triumphant in his train." Brother Jack Stead was another of the Oxford stalwarts. He had been brought to the truth by Brother Tipping in the early days, together with a number of other young men from the same chapel. I believe it was Methodist. For a time they used to go to the chapel in the morning and to hear Brother Tipping at night, but eventually they left and were baptised into the Christadelphian faith. This made a big hole in the Methodist congregation, and the minister called to see Brother Jack to try to persuade them to return, if only on the part-time basis as before. But when he found this was not possible, he suggested that at least they might send their contributions to the collection. It was at Oxford that I first met Brother Dennis Gillett, who was to become such a close friend and fellow labourer. Dennis had been a Roman Catholic before meeting the truth, not just a perfunctory mass attender, but a really dedicated Catholic. Indeed, he once told me that he had entertained the idea of training for the priesthood. At that time, Dennis did not have a car, so we used to arrange our speaking appointments as often as possible to coincide so that we could travel together. And we also were invited to a great many fraternal gatherings together, so that in some places we became known as the Terrible Twins. We enjoyed these journeys together, often accompanied by our wives, and needless to say had a number of adventures in our travels, not always pleasant, though always sustained by Dennis's perpetual good humour. I recall one occasion when we were both speaking in Birmingham Ecclesias on a Sunday, and had arranged to meet at the railway station to catch the last train back to Oxford. For some reason we had not used the car on this day. The train was due round about midnight, and we met as arranged, only to find that it was no longer running. The next train was somewhere around 4:30 a.m., and we sat rather cold and disconsolate on the platform, anticipating a 4-hour wait and a sleepless night. I remember Dennis said to me, "All those brethren and sisters we have been speaking to today, tucked up in their nice warm beds, would be horrified if they could see us now, sitting here for hours waiting for a train to take us home." Now, it has long been a guiding principle with me that it is better to be doing something than passively waiting for something to happen. So I suggested to my companion that we might set out to walk out of Birmingham towards Oxford, and perhaps somebody would offer us a lift. So we picked up our cases — no Christadelphian speaker is complete without its briefcase — and off we set to walk to Oxford. I suppose we had walked for about half an hour when we came across a fleet of 3 coaches loading up soldiers who had evidently been out on some kind of exercise, and as the coaches had Oxford on the front, we asked if they were in fact going there. The driver of the first coach told us they were, but when we asked if we might have a lift, for which we offered to pay, he stated that it was forbidden to take other than servicemen. Disappointed, we resumed our walk. Presently, however, we were overtaken by the first and second of these coaches, and then, to our delight, the third stopped and offered to take us. He had heard our request to his mate in the first coach, and although he confirmed that what he had said was correct, he would be prepared to break the rule for us in view of our predicament. Perhaps he also thought it a way of making little money on the side, but we will give him the benefit of good intentions. So, like Jonah, we paid the fare, 10 shillings each, which was quite a lot at that time, and very gratefully settled ourselves in 2 spare seats among the weary soldiers. I whispered to Dennis, "I wonder what they would think if they knew we were a couple of conscientious objectors." But anyway, we got back to Oxford about 4 a.m, in time to get home and have a couple of hours sleep before setting off to work. So my philosophy of action was again justified. For if we try to do something, we give God something to work with. But if we just sit back and do nothing, he cannot help. The people who didn't try to get their sick to Jesus did not get them healed. He could do no mighty work there because of their unbelief. A similar plight occurred on another occasion when we were returning from Birmingham by car, this time with our wives. Late at night we ran out of petrol, coming through Shipston on Stour, about halfway between Birmingham and Oxford, and found all the garages in darkness. We wandered around trying to find one that might be knocked up, but it seemed hopeless. Then at last we came across another motorist in distress whose car had broken down and who wanted a lift to Oxford. So we had a car and no petrol, while he had petrol but no car, not one that would go at any rate. It took very little imagination to arrange a marriage, and we siphoned out his petrol into our tank and all got safely back together. He was grateful to us for the lift, and we to him for the petrol. Needless to say, there was no shortage of conversation in the car on these speaking journeys, and I remember on another occasion Dennis and I were alone on the journey back from Coventry, engaged in animated discussion. We came through Southam, about halfway back to Oxford, and after some time Dennis interrupted me in mid-sentence to ask me whether it were possible that the lights in the distance could be Oxford City. I suddenly realised that far from being Oxford, we were heading straight back into Coventry. With all the talking, I'd taken a wrong turn in Southam, and we had doubled back on ourselves. I'm sure that other speaking brethren have had their own adventures and mishaps, and could probably cap these stories, these kinds of things are just a part of a speaker's life. But how many of those to whom they minister are aware of them? And if we experience such inconveniences in the work, how grateful we should be to be allowed to have even so tiny a share in the sufferings of Christ, who for our sake experienced not only inconvenience, but torture and death. Our time in Oxford was a bittersweet experience. We were very happy in the meeting there and made some very good friends. My new job was turning out quite well, and I was offered promotion to area manager. But Agnes, my wife, was becoming more and more ill, and the shadows beginning to lengthen. So I refused the proffered promotion, which would have necessitated being away from home more often. In the end, after 4 happy years there, she succumbed to the inevitable and died one night on one of her many spells in the Radcliffe Infirmary. I had visited her the same evening and was to have brought her home again the next day. But at about midnight, the police knocked me up to tell me I had to go urgently to the hospital, and she died as I arrived. I will not begin to go into details of what this means in terms of personal suffering. For those who have experienced it will know, and those who have not will never understand until they go through it themselves. She had been a wonderful wife and a devoted mother to 3 growing children, and her sweet and faithful nature lives on in the memory of a great many brethren and sisters who enjoyed her companionship and were the recipients of her love. Later I was to have my life repaired and my circumstances eased by marrying my present wife Ingrid, who had had a similar experience in earlier life and had become a close friend of the family for a number of years. I will say no more about these deeply personal matters, except to say that our second marriage, as it was in both our cases, has been a great joy and blessing to us, and a good recommendation to those who may find themselves through the misfortune of life similarly placed. With the Lord's blessing, such a marriage can be totally successful, and need not in any way diminish the love and joy in the remembrance of the first partner. It is not good that the man should be alone, the Lord said in the beginning, and it is still true. The companionship of a good partner in the Lord is of inestimable worth, and if one is sadly left alone through the icy finger of death, and by God's grace later finds another brother or sister to share the present wilderness wandering, this is a cause for much thanksgiving and joy. Brother Harry Taylor was recording Brother of Oxford at this time. In all these personal sorrows and joys, he had been one of our staunchest friends. He had been through the same experience of bereavement himself, and was a brother in every sense of the word. I first met Harry when I went to Reading as a young man in 1938. He was recording brother there. He and his first wife, Dorothy, were very kind to me, and I spent many happy hours discussing things connected with the truth around their table. Dorothy was a lovely woman with a very alert mind, but unfortunately death took her away from husband and family as it later took Agnes. There is no explanation apart from the general mortality of mankind. It is no use to say, why should this happen so early to such good people? The sword of death devoureth one as well as another, and there is no discharge in that warfare, as Solomon declared. Harry had married again, and his second wife, Bernice, being a qualified nurse, they had taken up the challenge of becoming wardens at one of the Christadelphian homes for the elderly. But again death intervened, and for a second time Harry was left alone. His experience in helping to care for elderly brethren and sisters had left him somewhat chastened and disillusioned, for he found them in some cases as cantankerous and selfish as those who had no pretensions to Christianity, and it saddened him. There are, of course, a great many Christadelphians who have managed to grow old gracefully, many of whom in our homes for the aged, and whose old age bears testimony to a lifetime of genuine discipleship. But there were some, he found, who boasted of the length of time they had been in the truth, and who wouldn't miss their daily readings for anything, and yet whose attitudes to their fellow residents and to other people outside was as selfish and self-opinionated as if they had never known Christ. This Harry took as a lesson for himself and a warning to others. He did not feel that it was enough to excuse such behaviour on the grounds of old age, saying, as we tend to, "Oh, well, you get like that when you're old." He suspected rather that it was the real person showing himself at last. "For when one is younger and has more control of oneself," he used to say, "it is recognised that some forms of outrageous and overt selfishness are quite unacceptable, so feelings are repressed for fear of what people may think."